amount of dollars in the world economy increased about four times. At the same time, we see that in China and in India emerge the new technology, a new economic system, which have much more complicated structure, which combine the central strategic planning with the market competition mechanism. The government control the money circulation through the government, through the state banking system. And at the same time, the private entrepreneurs, the private companies has access to the endless credit facilities, but they get this access only in those spheres which increase the production of the goods which have consumer demand. So this combination of central strategic planning and private markets and companies competition gives new opportunities for the economic growth. The government creates, the central bank, government central bank creates money. The government controls the circulation of this money. It's do in such a way to avoid the speculations. They give opportunity to the private companies have a long-term credits, maybe half, 0.5 interest rate, even 0.2 interest rates, which are provided by the government banks for those companies which are able to produce more goods and give more opportunities for economic growth. And the government at the same time block the speculations which undermine the economic stability. For this reason, almost all money which are created by the state are going to the real sector. Mm-hmm. And today we see that monetization of the Chinese economy about two times higher than American economies. Almost the amount of money which were created by the Chinese state bank during the last 12 years increased about three times. But this money was not going to the financial speculations as in the United States. It was going to the production sector. And we see that Chinese corporations like Huawei, let's say, or Xiaomi, or China Construction, or Power Engineering Company, becomes the huge built corporations. They were created, especially in private sector, like Huawei or Xiaomi, they were created just from nothing, from private cooperatives, which are growing up very fast because the government support these companies with the cheap credits. But at the same time, the government control with the use of the money. It's avoid the capital flight. The currency control is very strong. The yuan, RMB, is convertible only for current transactions, for trade, but it is not convertible for the capital transactions. The capital flows are controlled by the government. And all this monetary mechanism is designed in such a way to promote investments. You see, the Chinese, as well as Indian and maybe Iranian financial system, has a clear goal to finance, first of all, new investments, to finance the growth of production, which is quite different from the American and Western system, where the money are created for the needs of the financial oligarchs. They print money in huge quantities without taking care where this money are going. The main idea to get super profits. For this reason, they create various derivatives, which in fact are pure speculative instruments. And these financial bubbles concentrate about 80% of the whole money created by the Federal Reserve. And the mechanism which we see at the moment in the West, financial mechanism, is going through the turbulence. It becomes very turbulent. Every 10 years, we have the financial crisis. And there is completely, almost no economic growth. There is no growth of the real income of the population. So American and European economy is in stagnation. At the same time, the Chinese and Indian economies are growing up very fast. So the world economy is switched to the new center in the South East Asia. We see the new world economic center, which dominates now in the world economy by the growth rates. More than 50% of the growth of the world economy is the growth in those Asian countries. This center is much more efficient. It wins economic competition. And the Pax Americana is going to the end, not because Chinese and Indian economies are growing up so fast, not because they were in miserable situation before. They're growing up very fast because they have much more efficient system of management, much more efficient institutional system. So this new type of economic organization combines the central planning for central strategic planning and private entrepreneurs. We call this type of state as integrated, integrative state, or integrated world economic mode, because the main function of the state is the combination of the interests, the harmonization of the interests of various social groups. The American style system is designed for the needs of the financial oligarchy. Exactly. The American system protects property rights for the large capital, and they don't care about the workers, about the population as a whole. And for this reason, we see the huge social differentiation, which finally go into the political destabilization, which we have seen during the last presidential elections in the United States.
Exactly.
As for the new type of the state in Asia, we see the socialist ideology. We see the huge role of the moral standards. The state is responsible before the people. The main idea of the economic policy is the growth of the incomes and living standards of the population. So this combination of the socialist ideology, of the traditional values, of market mechanism and central strategic planning, government control over the money creation, shows the huge efficiency, and it is no doubt that the last part of the present century will be dominated by the competition between China and India. Unfortunately, cost about 100 million people killed in the two world wars organized by the British Empire. And now the American financial and ruling elite is trying to maintain its leadership, starting the new world war. We call this war hybrid war, because the main front lines in this war are going in the financial sector, in the economic and trade sector, in information technologies, and only the final stage, they use the military power in order to press opposition and in order to finalize the expansion in the financial and economic and information sectors. But this is the real world war, because the idea of this world war, hybrid world war, is from the American side, is to maintain its world hegemony. And they don't care about other countries. Those countries which are not controlled by the United States are going through the culture, through the color revolutions. Exactly. The Americans are trying to undermine political stability. In those countries which they do not have control, they introduce various methods for chaotization of those countries. They provoke wars between countries. The main idea of them was to provoke the war between Russia and China. Fortunately, it didn't happen. Now the Russia and China have strategic partnership. And because China is too large now, and American lose the economic competition with China, they're trying now to press Russia, to undermine Russia, to destroy Russia, in order to improve its position in the world by means of controlling the Russian natural resources and to prevent the growth of China. So American plan today has three stages. The first one, to destroy Russia, because, you know, the Russophobia is one of the long-term, have deep roots in Anglo-Saxon geopolitics.
Exactly.
The whole geopolitics theory of the 19th century, designed by the English and Germans, was the some quasi-science how to destroy the Russian Empire. It was the main headache of the Western geopoliticians to find methods how to destroy Russian Empire. And the Ukrainian crisis, the war today in Ukraine, happened according to the recommendations of their geopolitical theory, starting from Bismarck and then following with Brzezinski. They stressed a lot of times that in order to destroy Russia, first of all, you have to get away Ukraine from Russia, because the formula of Brzezinski was that Russia without Ukraine couldn't be the superpower. And all this Russophobia, which was have deep roots in the Anglo-Saxon geopolitics, now played a key role. Why the United States use Russia as the main goal, as the main goal to maintain the world hegemony? And Ukrainian provocation was prepared on the systemic basis during the 20 years, especially the last 8 years. They trying to control Ukraine. As you know, they organized the coup d'etat in Ukraine. The Ukraine during the last 8 years do not have independent government. This territory is totally controlled by the CIA and other American and British organizations. And the first stage for them is of this hybrid war. In fact, hybrid war began with the sanctions against Russia in 2014. And then the second stage was the economic war with China, where the American used the same methods as the British Empire used in the 30s, when British Empire prevented the access of American goods to their empire in order to get more compatible position in comparison with the United States. Now the United States did the same. They launched the trade war with China in order to maintain their markets and in order to limit the growth of China, but they failed in this war.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In New Mexico, the fastest warming and most water-stressed state in the continental U.S., where wildfires have recently devoured over 120,000 acres and remain uncontained, the oil and gas industry is coming out in force to deepen the region's dependence on fossil fuels. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Lena First Arai, journalist. This article is published under the heading, How the Oil and Gas Industry is Trying to Hold U.S. Public Schools Hostage. Here's more. The U.S. oil and gas industry wants to play a word and picture association game. Think of four images: a brightly colored backpack stuffed with pencils, a smiling teacher with a tablet tucked under her arm, a pair of glasses resting on a stack of pastel notebooks, and a gleaming school bus welcoming a young student on board. What do all of these have in common? An April 6 Facebook post by the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, MNOGA, asked, adding, they are powered by oil and natural gas. In New Mexico, the fastest warming and most water-stressed state in the continental U.S., where wildfires have recently devoured over 120,000 acres and remain uncontained, the oil and gas industry is coming out in force to deepen the region's dependence on fossil fuels. Their latest tactic to position oil and gas as a patron saint of education. Powerful interest groups have deployed a month-long campaign to depict schools and children's well-being as under-threatened government officials infringe upon fossil fuel production. In a video spot exemplary of this strategy, Ashley Neiman, a fourth grade teacher at Enchanted Hills Elementary School, tells viewers that the industry is what enables her to do her job. Without oil and gas, we would not have the resources to provide an exemplary education for our students, she says, adding, the partnership we have with the oil and gas industry makes me a better teacher. The video from September last year is part of a PR campaign by NMOGA called Safer and Stronger. It's one of many similar strategies The Guardian tracked across social media, television, and audio formats that employs a rhetorical strategy social scientists refer to as the fossil fuel savior frame. What NMOGA and the oil and gas industry are saying is that we hold New Mexico's public education system hostage to our profit-motivated interest, said Eric Shelker Goodrich, executive director of the Western Environmental Law Center, adding, there is an implied threat there. Last year, New Mexico brought in $1.1 billion from mineral leasing on federal lands, more than any other U.S. state. But the tides may be turning for the fossil fuel industry as officials grapple with the need to halve greenhouse gas emissions this decade. Before mid-April, the Biden administration had paused all new oil and gas leasing, and the number of drilling permits on public lands plummeted. In response, pro-industry groups are pushing out what some experts have called the sky-is-falling messaging that generates the impression that without oil and gas revenue, the state's education system is on chopping block. NMOGA did not respond for comment. Since February, NMOGA has flooded its social media pages with school-related motifs, like buses and books, but also with images of empty, abandoned classrooms accompanied by reminders about how the state's schools rely on oil and gas production and federal land for more than $700 million in funding. Elected officials have parroted this framing. This is a matter of critical importance to all, but especially to New Mexico's school children who have suffered greatly during the pandemic. State Representative Yvette Harrell co-wrote in the Santa Fe, New Mexico in February. But tax, budget, and public education funding experts say linking the federal leasing pause to a grave immediate risk to public education is deceptive. Any slight reductions stemming from pauses or other so-called adverse actions would have zero immediate effect on school funding overall, much less whether students get the services they need to recover from the ill effects on their learning from the pandemic, said Charles Goodmaker, former government and media relations director at the National Education Association, NEA. Now a consultant. The sale of leases does not lead to immediate drilling, he said. Often companies sit on leases for months or years before production occurs. Industry attempts to convince New Mexicans that the state's public education system is wholly dependent on oil and gas are based on a tough truth. Decades of steep tax cuts have indeed positioned fossil fuels as the thunder behind Democratic-led New Mexico's economy. In 2021, 15% of the state's general fund came from royalties, rents, and other fees that the Department of the Interior collects from mineral extraction on federal land. Oil and gas activity across federal, state, and private lands contributes around a third of the state's general fund of $7.2 billion, as well as a third of its education budget. Some on the receiving end of oil and gas revenue stress that not all educators and students embrace fossil fuel industry money in public schools. Mary Bissell is an algebra teacher at Cleveland High School in Rio Rancho, who co-signed a letter in November, along with more than 200 educators asking NMOGA to stop using New Mexico's teachers and kids as excuses for more than oil and gas development. Bissell says in spite of how cash-strapped the schools may be, many of her colleagues don't want oil and gas money. I'm not going to teach any kids how to find the slop based on fracking, she said of her math courses. Bissell characterized NMOGA's attempt to portray educators as a unified force beholden to oil and gas funding as disgusting.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Founder of Brazil's Workers' Party, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who served as president for two terms from 2003 to 2011, has launched his presidential bid as Brazil's October 2022 presidential elections approach. Economic recovery is his campaign's main promise.
We need to put Brazil back among the best economies in the world.
In an address to his supporters in the city of São Paulo, Lula called for unity around democracy. He also stressed the importance of focusing on Brazil's sovereignty and environmental issues. He criticized the performance of incumbent president Jair Bolsonaro, calling his administration incompetent. Bolsonaro faces a tough challenge to win re-election against his political nemesis Lula. The latest polls indicate that Lula maintains a comfortable lead over Bolsonaro. Many Brazilians are angry at the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, rising inflation, and high fuel prices. Bolsonaro has been widely criticized for downplaying the coronavirus pandemic from the outset, opposing restrictive measures for fear of damaging the economy. Over 650,000 Brazilians have died of COVID-19. Lula had previously described the huge COVID-19 death toll under Bolsonaro's watch as genocide. In addition, the government's fiscal indiscipline and the prospect of double-digit inflation have prompted the central bank to increase interest rates by 5.75 percentage points since March. Now, Lula says if elected, he has grand plans for Brazil's economy. One of them is to free the country of the US dollar. Lula da Silva has proposed expanding Latin American economic integration through the creation of a common regional currency. Lula says Latin American countries should use a unified regional currency like the euro to end South America's inclination toward the US dollar and to do bilateral trade with each other instead of having to exchange for US dollars. Lula has also vowed to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture to challenge Western financial hegemony. The five countries represent 41% of the global population, 24% of the global gross domestic product, and 16% of the global trade. Lula da Silva has also vowed to bolster Brazil's relations with other regional countries.
Now, that's important because still the U.S. dollar is used for the vast majority of trade in Latin America, and internationally still about 70% of international transactions are done with the dollar. What that does is it strengthens the U.S. economy and it weakens other currencies. So Lula da Silva is saying, why are we continuing to do trade with each other using the U.S. government currency? Why don't we create our own currency to do trade with each other? And I think a lot of countries in the region think that's a very sensible policy.
The Bretton Woods Agreement was negotiated in July 1944 by delegates from 44 countries at the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference held in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Under the Bretton Woods system, gold was the basis for the U.S. dollar and other currencies were pegged to the U.S. dollar's value. Since then, the U.S. dollar has dominated global trade and financial market. But now Washington faces a tough challenge, and that's to keep the crown on U.S. dollar's head as the leading global reserve or fiat currency. For many years, the dollar has been the standard currency used in world trade. The U.S. dollar currently has enormous power to infect the global economy with U.S. inflation and the impact of U.S. interest rate rises, both of which are managed primarily for U.S. domestic purposes. Add to it the economic sanctions the U.S. has imposed against other countries to achieve ends that complement or replace military efforts. Venezuela and Cuba are among the Latin American countries that have been victims of the U.S. sanctions regime. One of the consequences of sanctions is rising inflation levels. Hence, it's natural for these economies to seek ways to circumvent America's sanctions. For instance, since 2011, China gradually shifted from trading in U.S. dollars in favor of trade in yuan. It made agreements with Australia, Russia, Japan, Brazil, and Iran to trade in national currencies. It has been reported that in the first quarter of 2020, the share of the dollar in the bilateral trade between China and Russia fell below 50% for the first time.
It's an objective fact that the dollar is becoming less powerful over time. Even the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is dominated by the United States, has acknowledged that the use of dollars in international central bank reserves has been decreasing. Now, it's decreasing slowly. It's not going to disappear overnight. But in decades, I think it's quite clear that the hegemony that we've seen of the U.S. dollar dominating the international financial system is over.
Most economies are establishing different mechanisms to circumvent the U.S. sanctions regime and the hegemony of the U.S. dollar. These range from using barter trade to trading in their currencies over the dollar. The world is moving toward multipolarity, and the US is no longer the world's largest trading nation, it's China. Therefore, it's only a matter of time before the US dollar loses its dominance among global currencies.
At least three Israelis were killed and several others injured in the city of Eilat on Thursday in an operation the Palestinian resistance groups hailed as a victory for the residents of the occupied Al-Quds. The incident took place on the day of Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe, marking the anniversary of Israel's eviction of Palestinians from their homeland and declaring its existence.
It was the event when 3/5, 40% of the Palestinian population was expelled or killed or expelled from their homeland, Palestine, and expelled mostly going abroad to neighboring countries and even distant countries.
The operation took place after over 600 Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under protection from the regime's forces. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured, and some 50 others, including the elderly and children, were arrested during the raid. In a statement, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds is a red line and that the Eilat operation reflects the Palestinian nation's wrath over repeated Israeli desecrations of their holy sites. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement termed the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli forces and extremist Jewish settlers a declaration of war against the entire Palestinian nation, stating that Palestinians will continue to confront the occupiers and their aggression. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan has practically turned into a period of escalating tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli forces raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque culminated in an 11-day war between the regime and Gaza-based resistance groups in May last year, a conflict that killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. There has also been a recent surge in the number of Palestinian operations across the occupied territories over the past few weeks, raising fears that another war might be on the cards. The reactions to the mounting tensions have been particularly interesting. While many Western nations have kept silent about the developments, some, including US President Joe Biden, have been calling on both sides to avoid violence and exercise restraint. A parallel can be drawn with the war in Ukraine. Is anyone calling on Ukrainian troops to lay down their arms?
In a way, it's the same thing that is causing the United States to back the Ukrainians and to be against the Palestinians. It's the United States sees an advantage and in putting pressure on a potential rival to its power, in this case, Russia. They decided that Israel is the power that could help them to achieve that dominance. So it's all about, in effect, the United States ruling the world.
The normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has made matters even worse for the people of Palestine, despite earlier promises that the establishment of relations would benefit their cause. The Palestinians have vowed to continue their resistance until their legitimate rights are acknowledged. If the developments over the past several decades are any indication, they will make good on their words.
The United States is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. That title means a lot of responsibility, as every permanent member is expected to remain committed to global security and collective council action. But the U.S. has shown for decades that it is very much ready to take unilateral measures to get what it wants. A case in point is America's sanctions policy. The U.S. has gone outside the U.N. Security Council mechanism to impose tough unilateral sanctions against many countries. Even close U.S. allies may become a target of American sanctions. This is the Harry S. Truman Building in Washington, D.C. It is the headquarters of the United States Department of State. Many major U.S. economic sanctions programs targeting countries around the world are devised and enforced by politicians, diplomats, and lawyers who work here. From coercion and threats to financial punishment, the team does everything to make sure the sanctions are enforced. Perhaps the harshest sanctions ever imposed by the U.S. have targeted Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the Russian Federation. America usually defends its sanctions policy, claiming that it is aimed at changing the behavior of foreign governments. But ordinary people in targeted countries have been bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The United States uses the sanctions as a form of hybrid warfare. It is a form of warfare, it's economic warfare, and it's a modern-day version of siege warfare. So you can imagine that the United States, without committing troops on the ground, uses sanctions as a tool in its arsenal for regime change and for pressure campaigns, both politically, militarily, and economically, on countries that do not kowtow to it, do not bow to it, and do not follow Washington's policies.
In Iran, the sanctions have caused economic hardship for people, among other problems. Iranian cancer patients, for instance, have been hit hard by the adverse effects of sanctions. That is because many firms, financial institutions, and banks, which are vital in importing medicine, have been blacklisted by the U.S. State Department. Iran has been targeted by some of the harshest American sanctions in decades. Washington refused to give Tehran any relief, even at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, when all countries needed much more financial resources to battle the disease. Although Iran has many years of experience dealing with such economic restrictions, a considerable part of its problems are being blamed on them. They have put a lot of pressure on Iran's economy, causing its currency to lose value and pushing up its rate of inflation to unprecedented levels over the past years. Iran's UN envoy has called on the world body's Department of Global Communications to intensify its efforts to inform the international community about the adverse effects of sanctions on the targeted countries. Addressing a session of the UN's Committee on Information on Wednesday, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations said the use of the coercive economic measures are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, and the UN Charter. Majid Takht-Ravanchi noted that the sanctions have undermined economic growth in the target countries and prevent their access to basic medical equipment and materials by blocking their financial resources overseas.
People can't have access to proper medical supplies, food, different types of technologies that are necessary, for example, aviation. You can think of transportation, things like that. Raw materials that are necessary just for basic industry and production. And overall, you see that there is a massive pressure put on the population in terms of their economic power to purchase consumer products because of the sanctions that are imposed. So it puts tremendous pressure on civilian population.
Iran has in the past described American sanctions policy as economic terrorism. Tehran says the U.S. is addicted to such coercive tools. Despite criticism from around the world, the United States does not seem willing to change course anytime soon.
Outrage is rising in Spain over a hacking scandal. It has now emerged that more than 200 mobile phone numbers in the country have been hacked. The cell phones of the Spanish Prime Minister and Defense Minister were amongst the targeted numbers. Authorities have detected the Pegasus spyware in the mobile phones of Pedro Sanchez and Margarita Robles. Prime Minister Sanchez's mobile phone was breached twice in May 2021 and Defense Minister Robles's device was targeted once the following month. All in all, 2.6 gigabytes of information was obtained from the Spanish Prime Minister's phone during the first attack and 130 megabytes during the second, while 9 gigabytes were stolen from the Defense Minister. Spain's highest criminal court opened a probe into how the mobile phones of Sanchez and Robles were infected. Madrid has described the hacking as, quote, illicit and external attacks.
The illegal tapping of these phones has been proven in an ongoing verification that will reach all members of the government. We are reporting facts that are verified and reliable, not assumptions. These are extremely serious facts that confirm that intrusions have taken place in areas outside the state institution and outside the law.
The mobile number selections, believed to have been made by Morocco, occurred in 2019. Spain's socialist-led government is also under pressure to explain why devices belonging to dozens of people connected to the separatist movement in the northeastern Catalonia region were infected with Pegasus. The regional Catalan government has accused authorities in Madrid of spying on separatists.
So the Israeli Mossad has had a constant intelligence-gathering operation against any client that is foolish enough to buy their materials, and this is being confirmed in the Spanish Prime Minister situation. So the CIA, the MI6, and the Mossad have always entertained a mutual intelligence sharing operation, and this revelation of the Spanish Prime Minister is just another example of that.
Pegasus is a malware developed by the Israeli technology and cyber arms company NSO Group. Unlike most spyware, Pegasus doesn't require its victims to unwittingly download it. Once installed, it allows NSO's clients to take control of a device to activate the camera and the microphone, see geolocation data, and read the content of messages. The company claims the spyware is used for counterterrorism purposes, but it's been accused of helping facilitate authoritarianism.
Well, the Israelis are notorious for the development of technology that they can sell to dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, like the United States, like the United Kingdom, as well as others. But they always install a backdoor as well.
There are now serious concerns within the European Union about the spyware. In 2020, a target list of 50,000 phone numbers leaked out and analysed by international media and rights groups revealed that the list contained the numbers of leading opposition politicians, human rights activists, journalists, lawyers and other politicians. In France, President Emmanuel Macron is believed to have been on a list of potential Pegasus targets. And UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been warned that his office may have been targeted in 2020 and 2021. It's now emerged that the phone of Jamal Khashoggi's wife was also infected with the spyware. Khashoggi was a dissident Saudi journalist who was brutally murdered in Istanbul in 2018. The European Data Protection Supervisor, the European Authority on Data Protection, is already advocating for prohibiting the development and deployment of espionage programs with capabilities such as Pegasus.
I think what we're going to see is the revelation that the Israelis are spying on everyone with the blessing of the United States, and you're going to see a departure from their technology and countries seeking more more solid, safe communication channels, such as that which is being offered by Russia, China, and India.
NSO Group has already been placed on the U.S. blacklist. The decision reflects deep concern about the impact of spyware on U.S. national security interests.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Another point about knowledge-based production and response to this criticism is that should we make our production knowledge-based? We have actually raised the quality of working manpower who will embark on working in knowledge-based companies. Our educated youth. Today, a large percentage of our educated youth, whose population is large, are working in fields that have nothing to do with their expertise. They have given me a figure in this regard, which is very high. But because I myself have not pursued the matter, I cannot announce it here. Things are like this. This is a grave problem. This is, in fact, a kind of unemployment. A youth has gone through great trouble to study. The government has spent a lot, a long time has been dedicated to his studies, but they are not benefited from. This is a kind of unemployment. When we manage to expand knowledge-based companies, all these youths will be employed and the quality of manpower in our professional organizations will go up. Our outstanding personalities will be employed and they will no longer have to engage in occupations of less value.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One point that I deem necessary to raise about knowledge-based companies and knowledge-based production, of course, I have offered recommendations before, but I wish to add to them, is that there should be certain regulations for knowledge-based companies. It should not be the case that such and such a company, which is working by using a technology that existed 40 years ago, embarks on registering itself as a knowledge-based company with the purpose of, for example, benefiting from the facilities and privileges given to them. This is not correct. A knowledge-based company must innovate in the true sense of the word. There are other qualities as well, which I will explain later. I could equally mention assembly companies and assemblers. Assembly is actually a kind of unnecessary importation in a different way. This is not production. This is not creating a product. Rather, it is merely a kind of importation. Such companies should not be allowed to register as a knowledge-based company. This is not correct. Therefore, there is a need for defining precise criteria and indicators for these companies.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all. Gave me hope, oh Allah, I want to thank you, I want to thank
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subh Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical, and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Rumani near Jenin in north occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance. A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar. From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th.
If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
French President Emmanuel Macron was inaugurated for his second term in a bitterly divided France, with a major portion of his voters aiming to block the far-right's Marine Le Pen. Again, analysts say the first president to be re-elected in 20 years still lacks a broad mandate for more far-right economic policies. The Yellow Vests marched nationwide to send the message that they will not be intimidated or stop demanding more public opinion in public policies.
No, I'm never giving up, no. I've not been doing this for 3.5 years just so I can stop tomorrow. No way, no, no. Either we win or I die and these guys will carry on. People should never stop. They should keep going, keep going, keep going. Because this is what the governments are hoping. All governments are hoping that people give up and just let them do their thing.
The French left has put aside their squabbles and joined in a united coalition for the first time since 1936. Their goal is to prevent Macron and other conservatives from allying in another absolute majority in June's parliamentary elections. The left coalition hopes to force more compromise from a president long referred to as a liberal strongman.
Macron simply must not have a legislative majority again. The last 5 years were such a catastrophe. I hope the French people join us in the streets again because the prices of products are shamefully high, even products which are totally produced in France.
Macron's speech acknowledged the nation's disunity and said his key priorities will be the environment, the unrest in Ukraine, and European stability. The pan-European project continues to be plagued by perceptions of democratic illegitimacy and constantly rising economic inequality. A belligerent policy towards Russia may turn the Eurozone's ongoing lost decade into a lost score.
Macron's second term begins with unrest abroad, and if his first term is any guide, constant social unrest at home. Pitched social battles between Macron's far-right economic plans and a French populace unconvinced by economic austerity are expected to begin no later than this autumn. Armin Mazahari, Paris.
It's a warm welcome for an end to frosty ties. It's the second time in almost 3 years that Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau has visited Iran. His two-day trip began with a meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian. The talks were held behind closed doors, while the two diplomats briefed reporters on the themes of the discussions, which ranged from economic ties to the Russo-Ukrainian war.
We talked on important issues today, on potentials for economic cooperation. We also spoke about the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. I should thank Poland for hosting Ukrainian refugees in the Russian-Ukrainian war. Iran, for its part, has since day one called for a political solution to the crisis.
The Polish diplomat's trip comes on the 80th anniversary of the entry of Polish refugees into Iran during the thick of World War II. In 1942, Iran was a major landing point for some 120,000 Polish refugees who were forced out of Poland by the Soviet Union. Touching on the issue, the top Polish diplomat said Iran's hospitality created a cordial relationship between the two nations.
We are making the 80th anniversary of the exodus of